What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the Citizen Defense Podcast. This is part two of our conversation with Jay from Shepherd Development. So sit back, tune in, and enjoy the rest of this conversation. Be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast. Follow us on social media at Citizen Defense on Instagram, Facebook, and you can also find us on TikTok now, right? Yeah, we're admitting that. We're doing the TikTok thing. You can also find the video format of this episode on YouTube as well. So go check that out and hope you enjoyed this episode.
That's wild, man. And, you know, it's people don't want to accept that. I mean, you know, I don't want to accept that either, right? That I could lose to some random guy that's carrying a gun and loose in his sweatpants when I'm doing all this training, taking all this time, doing all. But it's the reality of it. Like you said, you know, I mean, guys get, you know, guys that went to war got, you know, got caught by dudes in pajamas and sandals, you know, and they weren't top-tier dudes. I mean, it's just – and, you know, they don't even have running water. You know, they're living in an environment like that, and it's just – it's kind of one of those things that it's great – it's great to be aware of it because – and, you know, luckily I've been in a couple situations where I – one situation I did kind of need my gun, but I didn't have it because it was earlier years. The second time, it was a misunderstanding, and a guy made a very poor choice, and he almost got himself shot. Luckily, it was in hand, but nothing ever came up. The guy wasn't unaware of it. This was it, you know, on our own property. But luckily, I haven't been in a situation where I've actually had to use lethal force or anything like that. So I don't speak to that level, right, that I can say that this is without a doubt the way to go. But I think this information is crucial because hope, you know, if I were to ever end up in one of those situations, hopefully that knowledge will somewhat, like, somewhere in the back of my monkey brain, I'll recollect that, you know, and realize, like, hey, man, speed and everything here isn't going to make the difference. You need to be aware of, you know, just have that conscious understanding that, okay, this guy's got me at gunpoint right here. Unless I can redirect his attention to buy me more time to be able that it's going to, whether he's looking away or something like that, to be able to give me a chance to counter ambush that, right? Being able to understand that you're not going to beat the already applied ambush, I guess you could say.
That active self-protection guy talks about that all the time, right? Never drawing a drawn gun. Mm-hmm. And he's got plenty of things to back that up. And that's 100% true.
Yeah. And, you know, kind of so we'll get into, this is great, by the way. We'll kind of go into some other stuff because there, like, some of the stuff that we're talking about here, man, I could easily sit here and, like, go down the rabbit hole. So I'm trying to cover it all and get us moving. But on the law enforcement side of things, you're talking about, you know, you mentioned guys that they did the study. It was just guys that went through police academy and things like that. Now, I don't have a law enforcement background, right? I have friends that are in or know people that were in law enforcement and things like that, shot with people that are in law enforcement. And it's definitely... I've heard the phrase that shooting isn't the only priority, or the shooting ability isn't the only priority, because there are so many other aspects of the law enforcement job, right? I 100% get that. While the shooting part may be a small portion of that, that's a pretty damn big portion, or an important portion, when you depend on it, your family depends on it, or somebody else depends on it when you're out there serving the public. So it always, like I said again, I'm not law enforcement. So it does baffle me that we don't have law enforcement that are, number one, they don't want to push to train to a higher standard. They just want to do their once a year certification and get back to doing their job. Or there are, you know, we have the industry, or not industry, I guess you could say, the departments that aren't pushing a higher level of training. It's just the absolute bare bones of what can we get away with that's not going to lead to any liability issues, you know. And like, you know, I'm not trying to throw anybody under the bus. This is just an observation that I've made, you know, personally myself. You know, what do you think about that? I mean, clearly, you're training to a higher standard. You're trying to push your department to a higher standard. When you see guys that aren't wanting to train to that level, is it just that, is it a complacency thing, or?
Yeah, it's complacency. It's an ego thing too. It's generally like a 50-50. Ellie and Millman, there's a lot of ego in that community. There just is. As part of that realm of being a tough guy and being out there enforcing the law or fighting the battle, there is just an inherent ego that comes with that position sometimes, because those are the characters we're trying to put in uniform that have the ability to be confident. And a lot of times confidence has some underlying ego to it, right? And then on the other side of that is complacency for sure, because of ego, right? I'm going to be good enough. I'm going to be able to stop this with my hands or whatever, right? If I had my way, yeah, everyone would have a higher level of training. They'd all be at least like minimum blue belts in jiu-jitsu, and they'd have a crap load more shooting. But I understand why we can't do that, right? There is a diminishing returns to the shooting sport when you have a guy that's not, you know, passionate about it himself, that he's going to put the effort in himself. You know, if we put a guy, instead of having shooting once a year, we put him in shooting four times a year, and that's all he gets, what are we getting there from that, right? So we've quadrupled our shooting with this guy, and he might get 5% better, maybe 5% better. Who knows, right? This is just a theory I'm having right now, spitballing this. But we have to be able to justify that cost of doing quadruple the amount of training for this much benefit in the shooting. And what is that going to look like in reality? If this guy gets in the shooting now with 5% better skill, and he sends 10 rounds into the public, again, we go back to the stat of 30% hit rate. So 7 of those rounds go out. Does 5% make him miss one less round? It doesn't, right? It's not enough. And again, this is complete just conjecture. I'm just I'm spitballing here. But to get a big benefit there, like when we're shooting, you know, say take our split times. If I want to get down to 7 rounds a second, all I need to do is my 14 splits, but to get to 8, I got to get down to 12, right? So am I doing the math right on this? I think so.
That's Jerry Mixler's skills right there, man.
So that the difficulty, though, from getting to like a 16 split down to a 12 split is tremendous. The amount of time that takes to do that is ridiculous. Like we're splitting hairs there to get what, right? We're gaining one bullet there out of our gun, which is awesome, right? We're being able to shoot, that's 8 rounds a second now instead of the typical at 5 or 6 rounds a second. So 15 splits will be 6 rounds, and 5 rounds a second will obviously be 20 splits. So 20 splits is generally like, you know, a guy that's been shooting for a little bit is going to be doing 5 rounds a second. A guy that's pretty good at shooting is going to be doing 6 rounds a second. And then the experts are going to be pushing into that 7-8 rounds a second category. But to get to that, the amount of work they've done to get past that 90 percentile is tremendous. So if we kind of backtrack from where we want to be and say, hey, where do we need to be to even get to that point? Like we're talking about quadrupling the shooting standards for those guys. It likely won't be enough. It's the same as, you know, I want a guy to be a blue belt because, you know, generally speaking, if we can solve a fight with our hands first and go and grapple with a guy and be confident in that atmosphere, we're generally more composed and we're not going to higher use of force options if we're comfortable in that environment, right? So if I had to take 2, I would definitely give guys blue belts before I gave them more shooting training, which is crazy because I like the shooting more than I like the grappling, but the grappling makes more sense in that context. But again, same thing, how much grappling do they need to have now? Do we need to quadruple their grappling training, and how much benefit are we getting from that? Like it's going to be minute. The guys have to be passionate about it, and they have to put in work behind the scenes, because there's no department on the planet that can contribute 1 day a week of shooting and 1 day a week of grappling. It's just impossible to do. You'd probably have to triple your numbers on your department to be able to get guys rotating through to be off the road and actually training, right? Which is, even in high level units where you're specializing, let's say, you know, SWAT and higher level teams, that same problem exists. Like, hey, we want to train. We should be full-time training. But then your op tempo is so high that your training goes out the window. So now our skill set is always just balancing between experience and our actual skill set. And it's just doing this at all times. which is a good thing because you want experience to verify your skill set. Because if you have the opposite end of that, where you have zero experience but your skill set's very high, you don't know how practical that skill set is in the context that you want to apply it. If you put the experience super high and your skill set's way down here, now our skill set is going to stay down here because we never have time to train it because our experience is so high, right? So we have to balance all those things somehow, and it is extremely difficult, man. Like, I don't have an answer to that other than, you know, quadrupling the government budget to put guys in uniform and train them to a higher level. And again, that problem comes back to square one of hiring the right people. You need to put the right character in the uniform to begin with that will do this for the right reasons, not just a paycheck, to be able to get that mindset of training out of it. If we hired the right guys right from square one, this wouldn't be an issue that we were talking about, but we don't do that, right? We hire guys with egos and complacent attitudes that want that job for the wrong reasons, and this is what we get from them. So you could fix a lot of this from the hiring, but that's not going to happen. If you try to fix it from within, you're going to have to push the training up to a level that is unsustainable. And that's coming out of our pockets, right? That's coming out of our tax money.
So I completely understand that. And that was, you know, the budget part I completely get. You know, every department is funded different ways. So one might be completely 100% capable, high quality training. And the other one is, you know, it's a small community and they're doing the best that they can with what they got. So I 100% get that. And, you know, I wanted to ask that question too, because, you know, with everything going on with police response and active shooter and things like that, all those conversations going around, I've heard people asking those questions, and they already, you know, they make their assumptions on what it is and why we're not doing this, or departments aren't doing this. And so I'm like, why don't I ask somebody that's in law enforcement, right? Kind of weed that out a little bit, because, you know, there is definitely a work-life balance. And like you said, with jiu-jitsu too, and grappling, I finally had the opportunity to start my jiu-jitsu journey this year. And like, I'm fortunate enough that I'm in a situation that it's essentially, you know, it's a small group of us, is pretty much private coaching and things like that. And, like, man, I am eating it up. But you talking about like the ego aspect of things, like, I'm kind of a limber guy, so I'm like, oh, this is probably going to be a pretty good sport with me. I can probably wrap up with dudes pretty well. It'll be all right. You talk about a freaking reality check, man. Like, what you think you know versus what you actually know. Like, man, I get crushed on the mat. You know, I mean, it's, and like, you know, we go back to making incremental increases. There are things where, you know, I'll get, you know, told something and like, hey, you know, you're doing better on this, or you really need to focus on this because this is what's going to be beneficial towards your overall performance or your body type, what's going to benefit you. But yeah, man, like, it's a reality check. Somebody that's like actually knows what they're doing. And I mentioned this on the last episode, like, you are helpless, man. And once they get you to the ground, it's like, all right, I'm just kind of hanging out while you're crawling all over the place and getting a position you can choke me to death.
Yeah, man. Yeah, there's some depressing moments there for sure. I've been out of that game for quite a while. I had a few amateur fights of Muay Thai and MMA a long time ago.
Nice.
And kind of like casually doing the training from here and there. And a couple months ago, I went in and I got tapped out from a smother, which is like one of the most embarrassing things that ever happened. Pretty high level black belt, got into full mount and basically just put his boob in my mouth and kept me there. I'm like, I could not get out of it. And I tapped his hairy breast in my mouth. So, like, wow, man, just like you said, like, you don't know what you don't know. Like, I never would have thought, like, yeah, white belts get smothered. Not, you know, I got some experience here. I shouldn't get smothered anymore. My goodness. It's embarrassing, man.
Yeah.
But yeah. Again, like, ego check. And it comes down to that. A lot of the answer, too, to go back to that previous question of why we're not doing it, is it's that 90-10 thing, right? We have a low-frequency thing, which is a shooting, which is super high consequence, right? Low frequency, high consequence. But that's likely, like, 1% or less of the job, right? So we have to figure out a way there to say, hey, we have enough skill to solve those problems when they come up without going overboard where we lose our skill in all the other facets, right? Of being able to talk to someone, talk them off the ledge, being able to drive, all those kind of things, right? Being able to be relevant on their case law and being able to make the proper arrests that need to take place and not be unlawfully arresting people when legislation changes. Like that does take time, right? There's a full facet behind the scenes there that needs to be trained constantly as well. And that's not an excuse to say shooting is not important, because like you said, it's extremely important for those low frequency events that take place. But we have to be practical about what that is. So what those are when they happen are generally going to be that 3 to 7 yards, right? 3 rounds, 3 seconds. That's what the studies show. And then in a low frequency, we're going to be taking a hostage rescue shot. And sometimes that's a patrol guy with a pistol doing that. And that's a horrifying day that they have to do that. But that is in the shooting realm, if we just even take that out of the context of like LE or MIL, that's like 1% of shooting. Like generally when we are pulling that trigger, that is a slap as fast as we possibly can do that. To actually take a slow, smooth trigger press in reality, like we are talking like a percentage of the overall shooting data, right? So going back to that 90-10% principle, if we have a cop that needs to start training, what do they need to do then? We need to get good at what happens the most, which is defensive shootings, right? Getting that gun out super fast and getting 3 rounds on target as fast as we possibly can. Good enough accuracy as fast as it can possibly take place. And once we're good at that, then we start looking at the little minutiae of, hey, can you shoot good with your left hand? Hey, can you shoot good from your back? Can you take a really, really good hostage rescue shot under pressure? Can you do that? Right? Because if we're not good at what we're going to be primarily doing from day to day in an actual low frequency shooting, then we shouldn't be looking and trying to specifically train the lower frequency events in that shooting realm. To me, that's never made sense. It's kind of like guys taking their left hand in a defensive context and saying, hey, my left hand needs to be as good as my right hand. Well, like, why? Why does that need to be as good as your right hand? Because to do that, you are literally halving your training with your left hand and your right hand to make that happen, to be legitimately 50% and 50%. Like both of these things are equally skilled. You're splitting your training now. So if I want that to take place, I am wasting time on my dominant side, which is likely going to be where it's going to be happening from. I'm drawing my pistol with my right hand. It's going to be in both my hands, hopefully. There's still a high percentage chance that it will be one hand, but it's likely going to be your dominant hand. To put it into your support hand, where again, we're talking down to that like 5% of shootings, right? Like that needs to be reflected in our training. So if, say, it is 5% of shootings, then it should be 5% of our training, right? Or maybe even less than that. Because again, to train our left hand really good, we're taking away from our other skills. To train precision shooting really good, we're taking away from our speed, right? You have to kind of take the practical realm and put that into your training realm, which is what I try to do with kind of that workout routine, right? We're going back and forth between like stupid fast and dumb, dumb, slow to make sure that our technique is still smooth. We're ironing all those kinks in the process. And we're going to be process driven with that to make sure that as we're doing a draw, everything's still nice and smooth. You know, and then next week we're going to go stupid fast and take the training wheels off and break that process to figure out where the weak link is in it and then restart all over again and keep building up from the bottom. Because if we don't do that and we just get back into like, hey, I just saw a shooting the other day. The guy just you got shot in the hand, switched to his left hand and finished the shooting in his left hand. Super awesome. So now we go and we spend like 3 weeks of shooting with our left hand to bring it up to like, 30% maybe skill level compared to our right hand. And now we've lost skill in our right hand. So it's just like this constant balance, right? And that's not to say that you're going to degrade in 3 weeks if you leave your right hand completely alone. Like that's not what I'm trying to say here. But that's 3 weeks of time that you could have maybe progressed to a higher level, right? On something that is more likely to happen. So that's generally how I try to apply this with everything is, you know, take that skill set that is likely going to happen in that 90% realm and train it 90% of the time. Take all those 10% exploratory things that might happen and take them into training 10% of the time, right? Otherwise, the training just gets, like, it just gets crazy, man. We'll go down there and we'll just start running scenarios that are so unlikely that it just kind of leaves you demoralized walking away from there. You know, you're like, okay, I just spent time on this thing and brought it up again. We're bringing it up like a percent at a time. and we're bringing these things down percents of the time as well that are actually going to be used. And that's always been a frustrating thing for me to see. you know, shooting. I'll leave that rant right there.
That's going to go on. That worked. kind of with that though, too. Do you feel that some people use, and this isn't just specifically to law enforcement, do you feel that a lot of people view drills as more and as an engagement method than a training method? Does that make sense? So like if they're shooting a Mozambique or a failure to stop, they're using this as a scenario of an actual engagement. This is how I would engage somebody versus as viewing it as, okay, in this drill, it's going to require me to draw, have a good established grip, fire two rounds in the A zone, be able to visually transition and fire two shots, you know, breaking it down of what the drill actually requires, you know, what it's going to require for skill development versus of, yeah, if I shoot a guy, or are they looking at it as, yeah, if I shoot a guy twice and he doesn't go down, then I'm going to shoot him in the head. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I don't think the majority of people are breaking down drills. I think if you tell a guy to do a Mozambique, his thought process immediately is, okay, I need to shoot him twice in the body, once in the head. How do I get those hits? Bang, 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 right? There's nothing that goes deeper than that. It's just, okay, I need to make those hits in the body. I need to make that shot in the head. To think that they're going to be thinking, okay, I need to be really nice and loose on my firing hand, so I'm not like flinching on this, really tight on my support hand, get target focus there, be ready to transition to the head. Like, I don't think that's going through the majority of shooters when you're handing them a drill. I think it's really just, I need to get the hits on target. Like, even when you go back in range and you make the shot harder, the only thing that I've seen generally added on a, I'm trying not to demean people, but on a, like a casual shooter's line is, okay, I need to slow down, right? I need to slow down and get my hits now. That tends to be the thought process because that's how the training's gone, right? If I want to hit rounds up close, okay, I need to shoot fast and make sure that I'm pointing the gun at the target, right? Like instinctual shooting. And then you get back and have to use your sights, and the training is now slow down, make sure you do a smooth trigger press, slow down. And I don't think either of those things are really getting to the minutia like you're talking about. So yeah, to answer that question, I don't think people are breaking it down to the isolated points of those drills that you want to do. Like for instance, if I want to do a bill and I want to get better at a bill, I need to figure out what's the problem. Is it am I doing grip checks when I come out of the holster? Like, am I taking time there to ensure that my grip is fine before I take those rounds, that first shot? Am I over confirming my sights? Like, what is happening that's slowing down my bill drill? And for me, a lot of the times it's that grip check. Like, I'll come out, especially when it's a high performance thing in front of a lot of guys, and I'm like, oh yeah, I got to go under 2 seconds. That's what they're expecting. Now your stress is up, your tension goes higher, and you draw out and you're like, okay, I really hope my grip's good. Oh, I better check that. Your whole brain there is panicking, saying, hey man, make sure your grip's good. You're about to shoot 6 rounds, and you get that stall, right? There's always that little delay in your brain that you have to combat over time. So for me, that's usually my issue. So I'll spend a lot of time on trying to relax that out. Just say, like, I don't need to focus on that specific issue that's coming up with the grip check. I need to focus on the things that's causing me to grip check, right? So my thought process generally when I don't have something specific I'm looking at is I'll kind of do a mantra, like loose, focus, slap, accept. So if I need to do something difficult, the first thing I'm thinking is I want to get my gun. And loose is what I'm thinking. I don't want to be over tightening on that gun and trying to like squeeze the crap out of it with my firing hand. Loose, 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 loose. So that's the first thing that's coming in my brain. Second thing is focus, focus, focus. So loose, focus, slap, and accept the recoil. Don't fight the recoil. Accept it. It's going to happen. You cannot stop it from happening. You know, like we're doing that kind of like high five drill. You're trying to stop that hand from moving. And even on your own hand, man, like you can like flick your hand. And I can do everything in my power here to stop me from moving that with my own finger. I know I'm about to do this, but I can't stop that from moving. So to think that we can stop a gun from moving, that's going to be slapping our hand back even more, is a fallacy, right? And that's something that I really push with guys is like, you got to accept the recoil. You cannot fight it. There's nothing you can do about it. Doesn't matter how much that gun is coming out of your hand. You could be Hulk Hogan. You can have all the muscles in the world gripping down on that thing, and it's going to move. Because of the same reason as this, right? This thing's floating in space, and every action has an equal and opposite reaction. That's boom. It's happening. We cannot stop that.
That's so, Oh, sorry. Right. That's a great analogy, the way you did that. And that hits, that really resonates with me, because I had, you know, when I was first, you know, really trying to start pushing in my early shooting, when I was really trying to start pushing my speed with the handgun, you know, I was very much, you know, I was seeing content from people that were, you know, I considered to be high level shooters, and they're talking about, you know, the gun staying flat, and you pretty much have this reciprocating mass on the top of, you know, on the top of the frame, and everything should just go where it wants. And it's like, I'm crushing and crushing and crushing and crushing as hard as I can, building all this tension in my shoulder, my forearms, everything, and this thing still is, you know, kicking back every single time. And it's like, man, I beat my head against a wall so much. It's like, I know I'm stronger than this little Glock 19 in my hands that I can't hold still, and everything's going all over the place. And it drove me up a wall until I really started diving into techniques and methodology and things like that of actual, you know, what are these high level shooters doing that I have not yet caught on yet. And luckily I've finally gotten the right direction. Right. And so that is definitely something, when I hear people say that you just need to grip harder, or, you know, the slide tells you everything, you know, the gun needs to be flat and all that stuff. It's like, man, that just drives me up a wall when people are telling folks like that, because they're giving them an absolute, like, there's a fork in a road, and you can go with the technique, or you can go with the fucking snake oils that this guy is telling you over here about this crap. And people always lean towards, you know, generally they definitely take off towards the snake oils. And it just frustrates me, because those people could be making so many more gains much earlier on. But it's just that there are these other people out here that are pushing the wrong concept.
100%, man. Absolutely. That's what I was talking about earlier. Like, I try to push theory and concepts that guys will go back and train, rather than a technique, because the technique itself, like, you're not getting those huge gains on mechanical changes often. You're generally getting them on concepts that are going to lead to very like large changes. Like, so for grip, for one, right? Like, minor changes in your grip, I would avoid, right? I wouldn't want to come up to a guy and, like, do that typical thing where, and I've done this a lot in the past, saying, like, hey, man, you're missing low left. Add more support hand pressure to your thumb there to counteract that trigger finger. You want to kind of make sure
this,
right? So squeeze this in there. That's a Band-Aid solution, right? If I add, you know, say this is at 50%, and to stop me from pushing over to the left, I need to have it at 60%. Well, how am I going to replicate that, right? I'm going to get to, like, 65% one day and, like, maybe 59% the other day. So now I'm pushing rounds over here now because I'm creating too much pressure. So to fix that, I would say, hey, well, we need to do something more structurally different, right? If all of your rounds are going over there and we can't fix your trigger press, then let's figure out how we change the structure behind the gun, whether that's your elbow being locked out or actually rotating in or outward. Like, every single grip is going to be different on every single gun with every single person. And to say a technique is going to work is extremely difficult, I've found. To say, hey, man, you got to come up here, you got to lock your elbows out, you got to squeeze with this hand, and you got to be loose with this hand. Some guys like having, like, tension on both, right? And that's, they're shooting properly with it, right? You look at all the different competition shooters, like, you got Vogel up here really high, you got Rafael with the finger on the trigger guard, and they're making it work at a high level, winning world championships. So for me to step in here and be like, hey, man, this is the solution for you. You need to do this technique. This will fix it. It generally doesn't. Like, you got to go back there with the concept of, hey, what do I need to do? I want to get rounds on target. I want my eyes to be focusing there. And what matters and what is necessary, and go back to the drawing board and play with the grip, figure it out, and see what's changing here and why is it necessary to change it? Do I need to change it? Right. First of all, if you spend time breaking something down, say you spend like 3 weeks trying to break down your grip to fix it to get like 0.01 seconds quicker. Again, would you have been better sticking with the grip that you have? And fixing that with it, like cleaning up your grip that you're using right now, instead of like changing your entire hand position, because is it this structure that's causing the problem? Like, what is it? We got to break that entire system down, which is kind of like how guys are looking. you'll hop on Google and look at kit for like 2-3 hours straight trying to find, okay, what piece of kit is going to give me a 1% boost in performance. When if you would have spent 3 hours there dry firing, it's going to give you your 1% boost in performance. So it's the same kind of thing I'm trying to do with the techniques. Like, you're generally going to have, if you have a good grip on your gun, like it's a forehand and a loose firing hand, you're probably going to be able to shoot at a high level. Like, just right there. Like, we're done. Tight, loose, look at the target, blam the trigger. And everything, as you start progressing with that concept, like those three simple concepts there, you can probably get to a high level just with that and refine that one grip pressure that you're using to an extent, right? That being said, like I'm talking with the 90% focus and 10% exploratory zone. Like I am currently trying to fix my grip. Yeah. So because I'm trying to kind of edge that out. What I don't want people to do though, I think, is when you're starting out playing with like 1,000 different grips before you understand what grip is to begin with. That's kind of what I'm trying to push here. Like, take something and make sure you understand why it sucks first before you try to change it, right? You get a guy on the range for like a week and you're going through like 5 different grip strategies with him. Well, the only thing he's thinking now for that entire week is, okay, my pressure's on my gun with this different grip. And he's not learning all the other concepts that are going to be important for him as well. So take something that works good and run with it till it works great, and then break it down, try to make it work perfectly, right? That's kind of my concept to make things work. So right now I have a very good grip, but I want it to be perfect. And I'm trying to kind of adjust something right now with my elbow position, which I'm finding is keeping the gun flatter, which again, doesn't necessarily matter very much, but I like it. I want to do that. So yeah. I want it to be flatter because it's nice to see.
And that's a good way to describe it too. And it's, you know, I think some of the guys that push like their particular technique or method I don't think they really understand how to articulate what's going on with their shooting and be able to relay that to other students. And so they just say, okay, well, this is what I can perceive that I'm doing. It's working for me. So I'm just going to tell you to do that. When in reality, shooting is such, you know, it's so personal, right? It's not this. This isn't, you know, team-based sports where everybody is a cog in the machine, right? It's all on you. And so I can't see what a student sees. I can't feel what a student feels. I can't perceive what is going on with what they're doing. All I can do is give them this basic, like you said, this basic concept of, okay, this is our goal. This is what we're looking for to lead to the achievement of the results on target, right? And when they can kind of understand that and kind of get like in that exploratory mode to where, like you said, shooting where the wheels fall off. Okay. Everything's breaking down and falling apart. Now what's breaking down? What's falling apart? Where do we need to make our changes? And then if it's like, say it's the grip, one thing that I think people don't, when they're trying to figure out their grip is like, consciously, like, put your hand on your grip, like, really just isolate, really focus on your grip, like, ignore the sights, don't worry about the trigger press, just whenever you're drawing and presenting, like, you're really thinking about where your support hand or the tension on your firing hand, wherever it's going, like, really put your mind into that member, if that makes sense. And kind of reinforce it until it becomes, you know, second nature. And then, you know, next thing you know, it's automatic from there. And it's just running in the background.
Right. Because the concept was right to begin with.
Yeah.
And again, that's generally what I'm trying to push is let's discuss the concept and come to an agreement on that. Because generally you can push a concept and have light bulb moments for guys. When they look at something in a different way, like for me, again, like looking at these iron sights, they're just coming up with different ways to explain why this works lately. And you can get those winning moments in guys' brains to say, oh, okay, that makes sense. I do want to do target focus because that's an awesome reason to do that. So I know now I want to do target focus. The concept makes sense. And then we can give them mechanics and options of how to make that happen. And again, all those options and the different techniques will work for different people. So you want to have a lot of things available to them that they can problem solve and test. And then as they're testing that, they find what works for them. And then you should push deep into that exact avenue that is working for you until the point that you have perfected it to a degree. And then understood again why it sucks or why you could get better with something else. So I always try to kind of like steer people into not giving up on something right at the start and trying to say, hey, well, my kit doesn't work for me. I'm going to hit on Google again there for another 3 hours to see if I can get a different mag pouch so I can do my reload quicker, or I need to move my holster a little bit. Like, no, like solve why that isn't working for you, because it's likely not your kit. It really isn't. You know, like the, there are so many different things we can do. And this is something that I did a ton at the start, was trying to find the perfect kit that would solve all those issues for me. You know, the rotation of the holster, like the cant of it, how far out from the body it needs to be, where it's positioned on the hip, same with the mag pouches. And again, that was only like changing my performance by like maybe 1%. So, you know, get good at something and then understand why you want to change it, why it's going to benefit you. And you're going to understand that a lot more if you perfect how it is right now, right? Like this today, I ran a few guys through, like these are all like concepts, right? So I have 13 things on here that we went through today, and there's not really drills on here. It's more so concepts. Like this is a lot of talking, not a lot of shooting, but you get the light bulb moments with guys with the talking, and then the shooting follows suit with that, and hopefully the dry fire. So for today, a thing with the target focus that I was kind of trying to push the understanding with is you have two wobble zones when you're target focusing, right? We have our with iron sights and with optics, but you can notice it more with iron sights. We have our sight relationship that wobbles. So these things wobble inside of each other, our rear sight and our front sight, they wobble, right? But then we have this wobbling on the target as well, moving around in relationship to the target, right? So we have the target wobble like this, and then we have the sight wobble. All right, so if you were to take your gun out and get a good grip, this generally, if you're looking down your sights with an optic or iron sights, are generally within like 90% of the time, again, that 90-10 rule, are going to be hovering on that target, right? Wobbling around there. And generally like 100% of the time, these things inside here are going to be dead still. They're going to be right locked in here like this. Like this isn't going to be moving around and shifting so much that you need to pay attention to it. But this is. Right, this is a big movement on the target. This is a tiny movement here. So what makes sense now in our context, if we sight focus and try to fix this while this is happening, right? If I do a sight focus, I can only look at this and make sure that this relationship between sight and sight is perfect. And then I lose my anchor on the target because I'm sight focusing, right? So now this is wobbling around here and I have no specific point to put it on. So every time I pull a shot, I pick another point now. But if I do the reverse of that and I make sure that the target is focused on, so that this right here, this relationship I know isn't going to change. It's up in front of my face. That gun is going to stay locked in. Like you're not just going to have your front sight just wobbling around like this inside. So don't worry about it. Just trust your sights that they're going to remain where they are and focus on the target, because that is what we need to anchor to, because this wobble right here is way bigger than this wobble. And that helped a lot of guys to say like, okay, that makes sense. We really should be concerned about the big wobble on the target rather than the small wobble on the sights. Which is the same exact thing with the optic. You just can't really, again, see it as clearly because you have both those things in focus. So that optic that's floating around on the target and wobbling on the target is your little wobble in your iron sight. And you just need to trust that is going to remain where it is on the target, like generally 100% of the time. If you put it up on, say, like an A zone or a small target, it's not leaving the A zone if your gun is up there based on the sight alone. Your hands are doing that, right? Same with the iron sights. Like this isn't moving. This is moving, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah, awesome, man. Like that's really good. I like that a lot. So we got into the weeds on some stuff. Definitely, we're going a little long than we normally do, which is fine. But so let's transition over real quick into some. We'll finish up on some of the drills that you're developing here, and the one that I talked about at the beginning. The make the shot drill. So I ran this and instant failure, right? Well, I say instant failure on one of them. I dropped one of the shots out of the head box, and it fell into the what was it? The not so social media friendly target version that you have. You have two different versions of it, and so yeah, it dropped into the handgun that the bad guy had right over his face, and so that was, you know, technically a fail. But I just continued and kept running it to see where I was at. So it's a very interesting drill and a low round count drill. But so just, I don't have a copy of it here with me. But the you got one laying in the background.
You're not right now.
That's okay. But yeah, so I was trying to take a guess about, like, with the scale down size of it, if that was a full size representation, what distance that would be. And the best that I could come up with was probably 7 yards, maybe. Would you say that's kind of close? Like, if this was a full scale, like a person representation.
Yeah, I really wanted to measure this, like professionally measure it. But looking at it on the computer, it's about 15 meters, actually.
Okay, wow.
Roughly. Within like 12 to 15 is what I was getting. So I'm saying 15 is cooler. But yeah, that's a far shot, man.
Okay, wow. Okay, so that was a lot farther than I perceived it to be. So now, for those of y'all that don't know what I'm talking about, this drill requires you, it's you start at, what, 7 yards on the beep. You have to draw, move to 3 yards, and then make the single shot, and you have to do it 10 times consistently under 3 seconds to be able to pass. If you drop a shot out of the head box or over the time limit, then it's an automatic fail. So it very much pushes, you know, you've talked about it here in this podcast about the, you know, the string of tens, developing the consistency, where your consistency lies. And surprisingly, I could consistently push it at probably around 286, 29-ish, somewhere around there, and have good tight groups. When I was like, you know, I'd see the 286 and it was a good shot, and it's like, all right, I can push this a little bit faster. You know, we're going to move a little bit faster. I'm going to try to get that shot while I'm on the move and settling, you know, kind of coming in like that, and then that's where I would drop my shot. But it's the, you know, it's a pretty awesome drill for such a round count drill. And what kind of gave you the idea of that? Because I try to think about drills that it's like, you know, there's some things that I want to develop, but some of it kind of crosses, you know, into other drills that already exist, and it's like, man, I'm not trying to recreate the wheel here. You know, I want to do something that's going to exploit certain things. And I mean, I personally, for me, I find struggle in that, developing something that hasn't been already done yet.
Yeah, I'm trying to come up with stuff that like builds that tension and that pressure. Like I have that trials test that guys do with the burpees and stuff, and that like to date, that is like the highest stress that you can put yourself under, like personally on the range by yourself. Like obviously competition shooting is going to be the highest stress you can get, which is why it's a good thing to get out there and do it. But you know, alone on a range, the only pressure you can do is really physical effort. And that physical effort is painful because it's a buy-in to the drill, right? So that the trials test is 20 burpees and then you shoot. And if you fail to restart, you're doing 20 burpees on camera on the beep, right? So that pressure alone, it's not because of the burpees, it's because of maybe having to do more burpees. And there's certainly a pressure on the brain. Like, and I was developing that, I was, you know, doing 200-300 burpees a day, trying to figure out how to make this work effectively. And we were testing all different sorts of exercises. Like, okay, we want some type of exercise to be done in 40 seconds that gets the heart rate up to a point that is, you know, as high as we possibly can get it in 40 seconds. So we were doing like, we're doing push-ups, sit-ups, we were doing dashes back and forth. And the only thing that could like realistically get it up to a high point where you're actually gasping for breath was burpees at a high speed like that. So you're trying to get 20 burpees done in 40 seconds, and then you get up and you shoot the test. So it really is just built from trying to get pressure into shooting, because my issue personally is doing those grip checks and having tension. And the faster you start shooting, the more tension starts creeping into your shooting. Because you can take a bill and run a bill consistently at 2.5 with no tension and keep shooting it consistently like that, you know, day by day. But as soon as you start pushing your envelope, your personal envelope, whether that's a 3 second bill or a 4 second bill, as soon as your skill set is meeting that threshold, tension starts creeping in. So for me, it's like, hey, if I got to do a sub second or a sub 2 second bill drill, like, yeah, I'm starting to panic right away for sure. Tension is building up. And that sucks. And that's something I want to combat. So I'm building drills like that to help with that. That one specifically, my goodness, that came from a scenario, close to a decade ago. There's a scenario set up. You run into like this basement of a house and there's a HR target set up. They're like role players. And this specific one was a guy sitting on a couch with a lady down on the ground, like holding her her neck like this while she's seated on the ground, he's seated on the couch and pistol near his head. And I was prepping to take the shot. So nice smooth trigger press on this. And the instructors there at the time had called it. They stopped the scenario and said, were you just about to take that shot? I said, yep. He said, really? And I was pretty new at the time there too. And that I wasn't able to articulate why I wanted to do that. All I really was able to say there is like, yeah, I'm confident I can take that shot. And we got into this retarded debate about like shot placement. Well, what if it glances off the side of the skull? Or what if we were able to negotiate this person out? Like you wouldn't have to take that risk on the shot. And I just went on and on. And I basically left there being like, wow, I'm an idiot. That was stupid. I shouldn't have tried that. When at the time I'm like, yeah, I'm confident in taking the shot. If that's my wife or daughter in there, like I'm doing that 100% of the time. I'm taking that shot. I'm not going to let someone else decide their fate. So I developed this drill back then about a decade ago and went out to the range. I didn't have a run involved in it at that time. That's a new thing, but I did stationary, that same kind of target. I wanted to do it 10 times in a row to prove to them, yeah, yeah, I can do this shot. And it was a huge ego thing. So I went out there, I made a very, very difficult shot just like that. Like that shot there on that target is probably like 4 or 5 times harder than what that role player shot would have been. So that's kind of mitigated my pain of this, but I went out there and tried to shoot it. I wanted to do it 10 times in a row and I failed in the 8th round. So I'm like, oh, they're right. Darn. Yeah, that's where that came from. I wanted to prove them wrong, and I proved myself wrong, right? Like, if I can't do this 10 times consistently, maybe I shouldn't be taking someone else's life into that risk matrix. I still think it probably is worth it. If you can hit that 90% of the time, right? Like, yeah, I'm probably going to do that. Yeah, that's where it came from. And then I added the run just to add a little bit more pressure to it. And the pressure, it's crazy on that drill, man, how much pressure you can have when you're told to do something 10 times in a row. And like it's working out, you're like on the 5th or 6th strain, you're like, wow, I'm doing it. This is great. Awesome. And then the pressure just builds as you go. And that 10th time, if you have a perfect run, your 10th round, there's a lot of pressure that you're putting on yourself to make that happen. So I'm trying to gravitate towards drills that are building that tension so I can try to fight that tension. I have no idea what the answer to the tension is, man. I have not got an answer from anybody. Really. Everyone struggles with it at a high level. And it's just like building composure and building speed to such a high level that you can backtrack from there a little bit to not have that tension. So be so fast on a bill at like a 1.5 that you can push it back down to like a 2.5 and have no tension and be able to do that 100 times in a row. Which is what we're really trying to do, like we talked about at the start of this conversation with training, is train at a very high level so that in reality we can drop down our skill level and do it confidently with low pressure, even though the pressure in that circumstance is going to be through the roof, right?
Yeah, and that's and not to backtrack, but you know, that's one thing I think some people see us, you know, they see what we're doing in training and think that that's what's going to be our, you know, if we were to find ourselves in a situation, that's going to be our response. And that's not really the case. You know, we're shooting this pace, trying to find the deficiencies so we can correct them to have better accountability when we're shooting realistically. Because the way, like, you know, my experience, and I am not anything special in the competition world, right? Like, I use competition as another training method for me to find out where my deficiencies lie to try to be better. So the way I shoot in my training is no nowhere near the way I shoot in a match, right? I'm a little bit more attentive to my what's the term I'm looking for? My confirmation levels, right? I'm a little bit more attentive to my confirmation levels, and sometimes that leads to me taking a little bit longer on shots than I would like. But, you know, I'm a lot more conscious of points and things of that matter, trying to make sure that I'm running the stage in the best way that I can. Now, I have run stages shooting at the pace that I have, right? Like, I go from that training level to that and don't come back down to that performance level. And it's like, shit goes out the window at that point, man. You know, I'm trying to do all these things and run everything and blend it all together, and my performance isn't there to shoot at that same training level. So that's, I mean, for people listening, you know, take that for what it's worth, right? Like, everything that you see me doing training on the range is not exactly fully how I'm shooting in the context of whatever situation I find myself, whether that's range or defensive. So, but yeah, man, so that's, yeah, if y'all haven't yet, go check out Shepherd Development. He's got some really good stuff. I definitely need to try the trials where I'm at right now. I have a little bit of a, we have 7 acres, so I have a berm in the back of my house. I can kind of go out and shoot wherever I want. The only problem is that we have sand spur, down in Texas, we have sand spurs really bad. And so if, like, stickers, like little stickers, and so burpees and stuff like that, like barehanded on the grass and stuff, might be kind of hard. It'll look like
I got to Google this, sand spurs. Is this like thorns?
Yeah, they're like, so what it is, it's like it's like grass, and what it is the seeds are like stickers. We call them stickers. They're sand spurs, and they have a bunch of little thorns on them, and that's how they that's how they spread out. So they stick to animals and things like that, and they get drug around, and then they fall off, and then they reseed, and that's how those work. But yeah, they stick to everything. They're in your socks. They're not fun. So barehanded burpees out there in the pasture wouldn't be the greatest thing. So if I can get that under control or get a good day at the range, I definitely want to run the trials. That's what it's called, right? The trials. Yeah, so I'm going to do that.
The shooting tackle on those aren't, they're not too bad. It's not like fast shooting. It's more so like focused, guaranteed shooting. So the time thresholds I put on that aren't, they're not very fast. It's more so like, hey, man, I'm guaranteeing the shot because I don't want to do 20 more burpees. That's pretty well the premise on that.
Yeah, if I'm probably, if I do the first set of burpees and don't make it, I'm going to have to come back on day two and try it there. I don't think I'm going to be doing it on the same set.
Yeah, man.
But so, yeah, hope y'all enjoyed this episode. We went a little long. We went an hour and 37 minutes on this. So that's, we usually keep it around the 45 minute, 1 hour range. So, but yeah, this is great, man. I'm glad you were able to make it on. I'm glad nothing came up. You didn't have to go on a top secret mission or anything on call out and everything worked out. So, yeah, man, I'll be definitely going to, I don't want to pester you, but I'll probably keep in contact with you on Instagram, on social media, keep track of what you're doing. And, yeah, man, keep up the good work. I like what you're doing.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. This was a good talk.
Yeah, man. So for any of y'all listening, if you haven't yet, go follow the podcast at Citizen Defense. You can find that on Apple and Spotify. And just recently on Spotify, we started putting polls at the end of our episodes. So you can go and, you know, respond to us. Let us know what conversations you want to hear. If you like hearing stuff like this, we can give you more of that. Let us know what you're thinking. Go ahead and leave us a review also. That helps people on the algorithm looking for 2A concealed carry training related content find us. You can also find us on Instagram at Citizen Defense. You can also find us on our website, which has the links to all of our social media, podcast included, at www.citizendefense.net. And we have a Red Dot Pistol class coming up on April 20th in College Station, Texas. If anyone is interested, you can find that on our social media page as well as our website. So hope everyone enjoyed this, and I hope y'all have a great week. And until next time, y'all stay safe.